This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community Radio. Each week, host Barbara Bernstein talks with local, regional, and national experts, activists, and policymakers about climate change, river protection, the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, salmon restoration, forest management, and all the other things that are critical to protect our planet. That's every Monday at 10 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO.
KBOO.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio. Of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Laura Wadlin, here with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Laura.
Tonight, our guests are Ariana Jacob, newly elected president of the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon, and soon-to-be past executive council co-chair of the Portland State University Faculty Association, and Ted Cooper, newly elected executive vice president of AFT Oregon and former president of the PSU Graduate Employees Union. Welcome, Ariana and Ted.
Hello.
Hey, lovely to be here.
As reported in the Northwest Labor Press, the AFT Oregon Convention was something to behold. Meeting April 28th to 30th in Sun River, Oregon, 101 delegates from 19 locals transformed the state's organization structure and replaced its entire top leadership with members of an 11-candidate slate. With roughly 8,000 members and affiliated locals, AFT Oregon represents classified support workers at K-12 schools and community colleges, university and community college faculty, and graduate student employees. According to the Labor Press, your Democracy Caucus was decked out in red sashes emblazoned with the words, "Democracy is Power." That is also the title of the Labor Notes book, whose subtitle is Rebuilding Unions from the Bottom Up. Before we get into the specifics of your democracy agenda, tell our listeners what you mean by democracy is power.
Thanks, Laura. Well, as y'all know, organizing is when members of a community or at a work site pull together with one another and decide what we want to change and use our collective work, knowledge, and leverage to enact that change. Big structural changes only happen when overwhelming majorities of people are deploying those resources together and taking ownership of making change. As workers, that's the only real option we have to build power, and it's got to be democratic.
Do you want to add anything, Ariana?
We were really excited to shift the culture of AFT towards something that was more inclusive, more broadly inclusive, and process-wise had ways for more voices to be included in the thought process and the decision-making process for our union.
Right. Let's dig into the highlights of the democracy agenda. The convention voted to dedicate $1 million to a strike fund. What's the significance of this decision?
The convention voted to create a strike fund and start putting money into it. AFT Oregon has more than $1 million, mostly from union members' per capita payments to AFT Oregon, set aside in this designated fund called the Solidarity Fund that is described as being for candidate and ballot measure campaigns, as well as to, quote, improve workplace conditions and to raise the voice of working people. We are exploring the possibility of moving a portion of that money into the strike fund or using it for strike benefits, but we also want to comply with law and policy around use of designated funds, and we're getting advice about how to navigate that. Traditionally, AFT has focused on legislative advocacy, but we believe that this convention demonstrated that AFT Oregon members are interested in organizing, and we look forward to collaborating with AFT to find a way to use that money in line with the will of the people whose salaries it was drawn from. AFT Oregon members also voted at this convention to invest in organizing, in building up strike-ready majorities at AFT Oregon locals. We need to carefully allocate the resources we have to do both of these things at the same time. Invest in rebuilding our movement so we can strike in the first place, and invest in our strike fund so that we can have access to strike benefits if employers or officials are initially reluctant to do the right thing.
So I'll just say that I think that in this season of labor action across our country, I think it's really clear that being ready to strike is essential. And that, so we need to make sure that AFT Oregon as a family of unions is ready to strike, and that AFT Oregon as the state fed can support our locals when they are ready to strike.
You also voted for greater transparency. What does that mean, and why is it important?
Me and Ted have been on AFT Oregon's executive council since 2019. And one of the things, I think both of us coming into the executive council, we came from locals and we wanted to know more, like, what is our state fed doing? And so we were like, we'll join the executive council in order to understand what's happening better. And then we learned that we wanted even greater levels of transparency. Even being on the executive council didn't necessarily provide the transparency that we were looking for. And so one of our real goals is to make sure that AFT Oregon decision-making is transparent for all of the people who are decision-makers, but then also more broadly transparent for our member locals. Because I think that we have to be accountable to our members. And I think we're actually stronger if we are including people's understanding and voices and decision-making in how we're moving forward.
You want to add to that, Ted?
Sure.
Are there specifics about the transparency that you would change?
Before, members were allowed to attend meetings with like 24 hours notice. And there were some rules in place about how to ensure access to information about when the meetings were happening and what we were going to talk about. But they didn't really work to bring people in. And then, like, even when people were ostensibly able to come to these meetings, it was like there was the big executive council meeting that happened once a quarter where a bunch of stuff got rubber stamped. And then there was like the executive committee, the small council that met on a more regular basis and kind of basically used the pretty substantial unilateral executive authority that the AFT Oregon president has traditionally had to make many of the meaningful decisions that actually ended up happening. And so, you know, it was like a small group of people like doing their best, but like just not very many people actually involved in making these like big decisions that are supposed to represent everyone. And so like we are going to specifically provide notice to all local elected leaders of these meetings. We're going to implement that with a shared calendar that we can like invite folks to. You know, any member can come to a meeting without notice. We found that that 24-hour notice requirement ended up being like really more of a barrier than anything else. And, you know, it's like if you want somebody to come and really be involved, you have to welcome them. And having this like gatekeepy thing on keeping people like creating a barrier in this way, just it wasn't working. It was making it weird. And then we also voted to make all of our rules, like the internal rules created by the executive council, available to members, and similarly to make all of our resolutions from our conventions public online. And that's really just like basic stuff. And yeah, I mean, the thing like all of this is going towards is like building a culture of participation and engagement in decision making, because like we only have real power if we can do that.
We're also working on updating communication systems. So there's just more ways for members to communicate with each other, for elected leaders on specific topics to communicate with each other, and building councils that there is ongoing conversations around specific topics that the appropriate people can participate in, and that then feeds into how we guide AFT Oregon as an organization.
The convention decided to dump Robert's Rules of Order and adopt a to-be-determined decision-making process. What's your vision for the new process?
So I'll just say one thing to note is that a lot of people put forward, a lot of different locals put forward the amendments and resolutions. So it wasn't like, even though we were an organized group going in, the slate of the Democracy Caucus candidates, it's not like we all had the same idea going in. We're still going to be working out nobody expected that everything was going to pass. We were all thinking about ways to democratize AFT Oregon, and different people put forward many, many different options. And then we thought only a couple of them would pass, but instead pretty much everything passed. So, but in terms of the Roberts rules in particular, the resolution will make it so that we're working on building out our own model of a modified consensus-based decision-making process. And that will go into effect once we, as the new executive council, have actually worked out what those rules are. And I think the goals for that is to have more focus on collective deliberation, a less focus on formalized process. But we also have to make sure that we are creating an accountable system that functions. So, Ted, what else should we say about that?
I mean, I think you got it pretty well. Like, it is an advantage of Robert's rules is that a bunch of like weird edge cases are handled. So like there is something to do when something unexpected happens in your deliberative process, and there's protections for the minority. It's like there's like stuff in there that makes sense, but it's like overall, and we've seen this over and over again in our meetings, like people who aren't, it's like most people do not know Robert's rules. And that means that most people are like excluded from the governance processes. And then they're just like trying to engage in a normal way. And someone is like, no, you can't do that. And that shuts them down. And that's not what we want.
So you voted to decentralize the executive position so that now executive decisions will require both of you, not just the president, and a deadlock will go to the executive council. And you've decided to share the president's salary and both work for the union full time and live in poverty. Why have you done this?
Well, again, I think that we saw that leadership needs to be more distributed in order to be meeting the ideals that we have around what a union can and should be. And it's also a lot of work. It's a lot of work. No one person should be the person who is the point person for all of that decision making. That's not the vision that I have, that's not the job I want anyone to have as a person in the labor movement. I also want the role of leadership for our union to be something that is sustainable on a life level for a living person. So I think that both me and Ted work well in collaborative decision-making process. We work well together. And I think that we make better decisions by being in conversation with each other. And then we also have the support of working together with somebody in order to field what becomes a massive amount of work running a union.
Yeah. Like, because there are constant interrupts coming in. There's like a just fire hose, like all the time. And then there's like this like long-term development, infrastructure building work that you need to do to actually like make an organization function. And it's like one person just cannot effectively handle both of those tasks. So like that's part of it. There's also, I mean, from the like checks and balances standpoint, it's like there was the only mechanism to deal with an executive who was like violating the Constitution or anything like that was recall, which requires a lot of time and energy to implement. And like consultation is like a normal part of deliberative decision making. We might as well formalize it.
Getting half of the president's salary will be more money than I have ever made in my life. I am an adjunct. I my annual salary is close to the poverty line and has been for years. And it is actually something, so half of a salary will feel rich to me.
So is this something that's formalized in your, now in your constitution, or is this something that the two of you decided and won't necessarily be mandated for the next executive or executives? Am I right?
There's no formal change that we have made saying that there needs to be co-presidents in an ongoing way at this point. So,
well, we did, though, amend the Constitution to require consensus on executive decision making by the president and executive vice president. We didn't say anything about how the salary works, but there's a mechanism in there for certain routine decisions to be designated as by a vote of the executive council as eligible to be made unilaterally by one or the other, or really anyone the executive council decides to delegate that authority to.
If you've just tuned in, this is Labor Radio, KBOO Portland. You're listening to Ariana Jacobs and Ted Cooper of American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. This is a community-sponsored, listener-supported, non-corporate radio. If you enjoy and rely on KBOO, please donate. Go to the website kboo.fm and donate or become a regular monthly sustainer. We can do this with you, but we can't do it without you.
Another democracy agenda change was to expand the executive council from 15 to 19 members and assign each member specific duties. Tell us about that.
So this is, again, starting from the place of thinking, okay, we want AFT Oregon to be more inclusive. We want people on the leadership to have more active involvement in decision making. What does an executive council look like that is more engaged with the process of running this organization? And one of the things that one of the ideas that came up from that question was having more designated roles so that people knew what their responsibilities were and then would be more invested. They would be bringing their specific work and life experience into the executive council and use that expertise to help lead the organization in an informed manner. And so by giving people specific roles, they assume a larger level of responsibility, and there's fewer people who are just sort of...
who aren't sure what they're supposed to be doing, exactly.
Yeah. So there's fewer people who you would come in with this new structure. You come in with a sense of, you know, what your role is and you know what you have to offer. And I think that we're hoping that will make just more invested involvement in the executive council from the get-go. And then it also makes the executive council stronger by having these more informed like roles being brought together and sharing that expertise. So
can you give us an example of some of the roles that people, like if they're running for an executive board position, what are some of the roles that people would run for?
Yeah. We'll have vice presidents for the different job roles. So vice presidents for part-time faculty, vice presidents for K-12, vice presidents for classified staff, and then also vice presidents for bargaining, vice presidents for organizing or membership. I don't remember which one it is there, you know, so just trying to both focus on job role and then also the kinds of executive council roles that our locals have.
So your convention also voted to end the use of outside lobbying firms. What was the reason for that?
When you engage with a contract lobbyist, typically you are not their only client. And so their interest is not exclusively in advocating for the causes that you have like communicated up from your membership that are like the membership's priorities, because like their priority is to maintain good relationships with legislators, and that includes basically like paying attention to what they think the legislators think is feasible and what is not, and generally pushing for the things that are like within the Overton window or whatever of what the legislators think is like realistic and something that they want to have a conversation about. And then, you know, also like they will be accountable to a number of other clients with different interests that might not be the same as your interests. And it's still like a relatively small number of people with a limited amount of lobbying time. And they're inevitably going to prioritize certain things that, you know, you've communicated are your priorities and not prioritize other things. And ultimately that doesn't work especially well for the kinds of like big structural changes that we need. Like there was a, you know, we were advocating for a bill for tuition-free higher ed in the state of Oregon. And, you know, that is like the kind of thing that it can be difficult to get a contract lobbyist to like take seriously and help you with.
I think that's a great answer. I think the other part of it is that in our vision for what we ideally want AFT Oregon to be, we want members to be very involved in advocating, doing the political advocacy and building those political relationships. And we feel like that will be a stronger approach to political advocacy if once we get like a strong political team going from across the locals. So,
before we wrap up, we want to make sure our listeners understand the complexity of school-based unions in Oregon. The American Federation of Teachers, AFT Oregon, is the state organization. And you might think that must be the union that Oregon teachers belong to, right? Well, not exactly. The Oregon Education Association represents K-12 teachers in Oregon. AFT Oregon brings together school support workers, college faculty, and grad student workers. And AFT Oregon itself is just one of four large Oregon unions directly affiliated with the national AFT, which has 1.7 million members. The other Oregon unions affiliated with national AFT are Oregon School Employees Association, Oregon Nurses Association, and Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. So finally, we want to give Ariana a chance to give us an update on your contract struggle at PSUFA, the part-time faculty union at Portland State University. What are your demands and how is administration responding? What's next?
Well, we've just started an economic reopener at PSUFA, and so far, all we've really accomplished is getting ground rules written. We've been working for a couple months on that, actually. It can be a lot of work just to get going in this process of bargaining. And so the has been our demands in the past, but we are looking for equal pay for equal work. So the reality of part-time faculty is that not only are we paid way less per per class than our full-time faculty are paid for teaching the same class. We also don't receive benefits. So we are paid, we cost the school immensely less than other faculty, but we're now doing like over close to 40% of the teaching work at PSU is part-time faculty. And part-time faculty are, we're contractually set up to only be able to teach under the 0.5 limit so that we can never access benefits. So equal pay for equal work is a big priority for us. And then within that umbrella, almost all of our adjunct faculty are paid at a minimum per credit rate, and there's no advancement. So that there's nothing beyond that. We have people who've worked for decades at Portland State, and there's no longevity raises for anyone. So not only are we paid less overall, there's like other faculty advance and we don't. So we're also going to be fighting for length of service increases. We're going to be fighting for ending all the unpaid work that people are doing, which is a lot of unpaid work. We're fighting for access to some benefits. That's a big struggle. We do have some benefits funds, so we're fighting for greater access to that, but then also we're fighting for access to retirement and sick leave and health insurance. And we're also fighting for the ability to be paid to attend our own faculty meetings. That's another thing that's difficult for part-time faculty, is that because we're paid differently, we're often barred from going to our own faculty meetings because we would have to be paid separately for that. And for the most part, that means that we are not allowed to do that. So we're fighting that to be able to be included, because with that, we're able to actually provide contextual information about being a member of the PSU community to our students, which is incredibly important. I think that's the overview. I hope that's an appropriate level of detail.
Is there a what's next yet?
In terms of the bargaining?
Yeah, or community solidarity.
Yeah, so our next bargaining session will be on May 30th in the morning, and then we have another session on June 2nd. Those are one of the things we do have the right to in our ground rules, is have it be open bargaining. So you can be an observer. You can be an observer as a community member. I think, let me see, in terms of recommending that people sign up, you can go to our website, but I actually can't figure out in my brain what's the, maybe I'll figure out later and I can tell you the actual link of what would be a good place to sign up. So observers can come, and that it's actually incredibly powerful to have observers in the room, observers that are adjuncts and observers that are community members and observers that are students. That really changes the dynamics in the room in terms of how management takes us seriously. So that's what's next.
Great. And I have been in the room at bargaining sessions a few contracts ago, and it is quite powerful. I loved it, frowning at management from across the room.
Thank you for being there, Jamie. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
So that wraps it up for this evening's show. You've been listening to Ariana Jacob and Ted Cooper of the American Federation of Teachers Oregon. Thanks to my co-host, Laura Wadlin. I'm Jamie Partridge. This is Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the Free Music Archive,
an interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and/or spouses. Matching gifts are a great way for you to maximize your membership dollars. Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starved to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition, but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, May 26th at 10 a.m. here on 90.7 KBOO FM. If you love animals, and especially dogs,